Okay, welcome to Myth. So we have a lot to talk about. Maybe you know some myth already. Do you remember some from college, maybe? Okay, that's even better than it will be all new and I can say whatever I want, right? Okay, so 2 hours is a long time to sit, so we'll do maybe an hour and have a 10-minute break in the middle. Okay, so first let's talk about what is myth. Why are we interested in myth? Sorry?
Check the mic. It doesn't sound like it's on back here.
It's not a mic. It's me. This is a recorder. Okay. So, that's not a mic. Okay, so what is myth? Why are we interested in myth? Well, there's many ways that myth is interesting. Myth is actually coming back. Myth is all around us, I think.
Yeah.
It's always with us, right? You think. Maybe it's always part of culture. That it's an important part of culture, you think? And politics, of course. We need myths. Sometimes we have to see through myths, like you're suggesting, right? As part of psychology, Freud talked about the Oedipus complex, and people spend thousands of dollars trying to figure out if they have something for mythology in their mind, right? So there's many ways to see myth. So let's just say a few things to start out. And there's many more. And as we go, we'll tell stories, but we're not just telling stories. We'll comment on them and bring out interesting ideas. So what is interesting about myth? Okay, here's about 3 points to start out. One, and of course you have your own reasons, which you should speak up and say and ask questions as we go. So I have three just to note it first. One is that we often think myth is an earlier way of thinking, like the way they explained things before they had science. For example, they didn't know how volcanoes worked, so they made up a story that there's some fire-breathing monster under the volcano, right? Or that Zeus throws the lightning bolts, and so on, right? That we think of it as pre-science, and some myths are like that. Some myths explain things like that. Although, actually, that's not the way ancient people thought about everything, because they knew much more than that, right? So, but if we think of it that way, that then we tend to think, well, myth is something really old, a long time ago, when they didn't know what was going on, so they made up these stories, and then later on they learned it, and they didn't need myth anymore. They got reason and science, or in Greek that would be logos, L-O-G-O-S. People think it means word. We hear that, but it means a lot more than word, like reason, thought, speech. So there's a common kind of pattern that people go from myth to reason, and in other words, that you outgrow myth, it's something for children. You tell children, but then they learn that there's no Easter Bunny, things like that, right? Sorry to disappoint you about the Easter Bunny. Right? So that's one view of myth, but it's changed now, because in the 20th century, for the past 100 years at least, people have come to appreciate this way of thinking more. Myth has grown. It's become a lot bigger. We realize that it's an important way of thinking, that we can't be all logic. Freud was one of the big people to start that. He wrote a lot. So this would be point number two, that myth is coming back in modern times. Freud studied myth and said, myths are always in our unconscious. Myths are like dreams. We have them in our unconscious, he said, from the childhood of the race, the prehistory of the race that's wired in our brains. Now, nobody's really an Orthodox Freudian much anymore, but this is part of a whole view, late 19th century, sorry, about 1900 on, which is this view, that the world is so modern, the world is becoming so interested in building factories and cars. Isn't there something else than just polluted cities and smoke and modernism? It comes in with this disenchantment about modernity. And there's a theory called the disenchantment of the world, actually, that the world is losing something if we're all about materialism, that we're losing values, we're not happy, this whole kind of view, that we're becoming disenchanted or we're losing enchantment that they used to have with this view that the world was populated by fairies and magic and surprising things. So this has been why folk tales of myth have been big in the past 100 years, this view that we need enchantment in our lives. That would be kind of like Walt Disney or kind of things in Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream, right? That, in other words, life is not all logic. And Joseph Campbell was like this. Do you remember Joseph Campbell? Have you seen him on TV? Maybe he got you interested in myth, right? With him, it's a spirituality. It kind of becomes New Age spirituality, actually, with his followers. So there's all kinds of reasons there. In other words, people promote myth and want it, and they say it's part of life and not something we outgrow, or not something just for children or for really early primitive people who didn't understand things, right? It's one side that's the non-rational side. Okay, so that would be saying that myth is still with us. And so as a third general point about myth, don't we still have myth all around us still today? Right? It's not just something from ancient times. Where do we have myths today? Okay. Well, you seem to think government requires myth, right? Maybe we don't want the truth. I hope we do. But what's an example of a myth we have? Yeah, well, I would agree with you there, but that's controversial. I can't say everything I think about that. But, okay, there's that. That's true. That's actually one of my themes, that these myths that we'll have from the ancient world, these are the basis of our religions today, right? So one would be, say, Noah's Ark. That's a story. That's an ancient story, which you see everywhere. You know, when you have a kid, people give you all this stuff with Noah's Ark all over it, right? And we want these kind of stories, right? People don't do historical research. Did it really happen? It's a story that we wanted because of the religious messages it comes with, right? What about Santa Claus? Do you think that is funny, right? We have Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy.
The Jersey Devil.
The Jersey Devil, right? Right? So do you think partly we want these? We want to think, well, there's these places full of surprises, like at the edge of the world, if you go into the woods, there's a devil there. So we kind of want that, so it's not all boring and paved with highways and things, right? But anyway, we have it all around us. Look at Santa Claus. Maybe you think when you have a child, well, I don't know if I should promote Santa Claus. Why should I perpetuate this myth? And you might think about that, but you really have no choice. You have to do it, right? It's everywhere. The adults want it just as much as the kids, right? So look what so it's not just for kids. Do adults need this? Do we need to do this? And why do we do that? Because look what we do. We don't just say, okay, there's a story about Santa Claus. We leave out the milk and cookies. And we say, look, he came. He ate the cookie. There's the crumbs. He drank the milk. We invent evidence to try to prove a false story, right? So what is that? We have to try to make it empirical, and we know it's made up. Maybe the adults are the nutty ones there. Right? My 8-year-old just said, but adults all made this up? What? You know? We have Harry Potter. Isn't that mythology? Right? It's full of centaurs and magic, and that's why it's popular. Or novels and films in general are storytelling, and we need storytelling. Even politics needs it, right? We don't say we're going to war because we're going to take the oil. We want to make it a nice story, right? And we want that because, you know, that will motivate people more. Look at the O.J. Simpson trial. This is an example, right? They didn't want the facts. They didn't want the DNA statistics, which were pretty overwhelming. They wanted a certain story that, you know, the one that was more appealing to them, right? So you could say this is part of the way we think. We tell stories. What about, say, America? George Washington. What's the myth about George Washington? Sure. Did that actually happen? Well, you might think not, because it's so obviously a didactic tale. The message, it just hits you over the head with the moral, right? It's so kind of clunky and obvious, right? That's actually made up. The cherry tree, I can't tell a lie. That was made up by Washington's first biographer, someone named Parson Weems. Right there, Parson was trying to tell this moral tale that the father of the country had to be an example for everyone, a moral example. And just the word father of the country isn't that mythology, right? I think he didn't have any children, did he? Did he?
Not biological.
Oh, is that right? Okay. There's a case of a clear moral political message, and some myths do that, but they do many different things. They're not all that obviously moral. We have other ones, like, say, Paul Bunyan clearing the woods. that went along with American expansion, right? So that's political. Or what about Thanksgiving? So when we have holidays like Halloween, Valentine's Day, Thanksgiving, right? We always have stories about why we do this on that holiday, right? So the paper will say Valentine's Day comes from this. But these are really myths, right? So we kind of act out myths on these holidays, Christmas, right? And then go back to ancient stories, you know, was there a St. Valentine, was there a St. Nick, things like that. And then we act it out. Is that? Sure.
Are they the same thing as myths?
Well, it's very similar. Well, for now, I'm grouping it all together very broadly that myth is this whole way of thinking. If you want to say, is there a difference between myth and fairy tale, then there is. But we don't need to be caught up on that too much. A fairy tale is a little more generic. A fairy tale would be like a wicked princess in a castle. It's kind of an unreal time and an unreal place. But it's very similar, what we're talking about is very similar. And the Grimm brothers actually went and collected these in order to say something about the Germans, about the folk, right, the Volk, the people, to have popular origins of to make, you know, political points about in the Romantic period. They were interested, you know, in the popular stories and not just high-class rulers. And Disney picked this up. You know, so many Disney stories come from the Brothers Grimm. By the way, the Brothers Grimm, they published several collections of their tales. And they changed. The stories changed over time. They became more and more Christian. Because they were told, you have to make these edifying tales. So they became more Christian. One of the brothers died, and the other one did the later editions that were totally Christian, like things like Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, right, are about basically somebody coming back from death. Like, right, love will resurrect you, love will save you, you know. These are not Greek messages, by the way. That's very Christian, and Disney picked that up. So all these movies have, you know, really strong messages there that we don't always see. Although, in the later Disney movie, The Lion King, it's a different message, right? It's not like that. It's a circle of life, right? No, they don't always have to be positive, but because they're about life, and they could have a message that life is difficult and hard and tragic. This is the Greek view.
For example, Count Dracula. Or,
yes.
Werewolves and all.
Right. Do they have a positive? Okay, you maybe mean a happy ending, right? In these stories, does the good guy always win? Does somebody always like put a hex on Dracula and win?
Yeah, you know, the myth to me is just the existence of these things, which is not pleasant at all.
Right, it shows something about fears, right? The fears of the unknown, right? We have the known world, and these things usually take place at the boundaries, right? Like the Jersey Devil down in the swamp somewhere to the south, right? Or someplace in Transylvania. That they express fears, maybe psychology, maybe something about a dark side in life itself, that we need these. We need to think we're battling the evil forces, you know, all the... Well, that's right. They're always saying something, right? The truth can be many different things. It doesn't always have to be historical truth. It doesn't have to be that Dracula happened and Noah's flood happened, although that's often the first thing people want to know. The truths are really much more interesting than that. The very reason we have these myths is not because we're saying something had happened in 4,400 BC or whatever, but we're saying something about now and us that we want now for our culture. So they have meanings and truths. And my view is that the kind of existential truth, they tell us about the world and existence, right, and about human beings and life, and many different things. They tell us about history, they tell us about psychology, about society, politics, you said. They tell us about religion, since our religions come from the ancient world, and really ancient stories are the basis for the major religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, right? And you could, so actually when we see these Greek stories, this was their religion. That means it was very serious. Their view of existence. They weren't just cute stories for children, they were deadly serious. Like you said, they're not always happy. Because, you know, life isn't always happy. So you could say, myth is a religion you don't believe anymore. Right? This was a religion to the Greeks. Religion changed, so we say that one's a myth. Right? Anyway, it has a real religious element. So, okay. Yes, and there's a lot of things you said. We'll see these all throughout. I was just mentioning holidays. Say with Thanksgiving, right? We have myths about why we celebrate Thanksgiving. The myth about the first Thanksgiving feast. Did that actually happen that way? Right? No. We tell the story. Yeah.
But there's a book that just came out called Yes? Mayflower.
Yeah, I saw that. I was reading part of that. Yeah.
Yeah, which describes what really happened, which is very different.
Exactly.
From the there was a party, but it was not the way it is described in Thanksgiving.
Exactly. That would be a good read. I love adult audiences because you read books and the students are good, right? And the students are like, do we have to know this? Is this on the test?
Everything you learn in elementary school is a myth.
Because yeah.
Because when you get to high school, you find out there are other things that happen. And then when you get higher up and study history more, you find out that, you know, what you learned earlier was not completely true.
Exactly.
So all of your life, you
keep learning.
That are not so.
That's right. So I hope there's things here you haven't heard, because here we have kind of the roots of our culture, right? These ancient foundations that are, they're not just cute stories, you know, because sometimes people say, well, I want to read the Greek and Roman stuff, because you hear people mention Ulysses everywhere, as if it's just like an illusion that people like to mention it for decoration. But it's not. It's the basic foundation of our culture. So the things here, you learn more, you know, to keep examining the things we hear, the roots of things we're familiar with already. Like you said, they're different than we expect. It makes you think about everything in a new way.
But today, don't you think, and probably it is in the past also, isn't myth a wish or a means for transcendence? Today, even we would create or want. Mm-hmm. Heroes.
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
Things like that.
Yes.
So it seems that it really has a psychological use.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's where it will always have an important function, because it's everything that's not logic or facts or, you know, material reality. That it's these other areas we want, whether it's the unconscious, whether it's some realm of spirits that where we want to get at what's out there, you know, what's the meaning. Exactly, that's what we want. And Greek heroes are very much about that. Joseph Campbell was very much about that, although I'm not going to really follow his line. So, you know, some you can be more spiritual than others, but that's definitely true.
What about the fables of Aesop? Would that be...
Okay, well, that's similar, although fable is a different term. Fable means the fabulous, and these are like talking animals. So myth, we'll say in a minute, this definition, myth purports to take place at a certain time and a real place. Like Hercules lived in this place, he was a king, or actually he wasn't a king, but most of them are kings here, roughly in this time, they're our ancestors. So myth is like legendary history, where fables are more, you know, talking animals, fabulous things, which of course have moral purposes, so they're a type, you can say they're a type of myth if myth is very broad. And folk tales and folklore are more generic, like the princess, where it's not a real place. It doesn't purport to be history. It's more like types, the wicked stepmother and so on.
It seems to me that there are two different kinds of myth.
Yeah.
One which is based on something that really happened,
uh-huh.
but is embellished and reinterpreted, like the Thanksgiving dinner. On the other hand, something like telling you that the earth is sitting on a turtle.
Yeah, right.
That's a complete fantasy.
You don't think it's right?
Well,
you know how the story goes.
To be a physicist, so yeah. I don't think so.
Well, you know how the story goes. The earth is sitting on a turtle. Then you ask, what's that turtle sitting on? It's turtles all the way down. Right? Native American, right?
Some based on the reality
and some not. Sure, and I would say these all explain the unknown, and I would agree with you that they all have a religious aspect, that which is also about explaining the unknown. We don't like this void, this gap at the beginning of time or the beginning of creation, so it has all those elements. It's a lot there, so let's see these. Okay, so actually I didn't introduce myself. So my name is John Lenz, and I'm from the Classics Department at Drew. I should have said that first for this little thing they're going to put on the web here. And I teach myth quite often, and I use this book for a textbook, Classical Myth by Barry Powell. Did he give you a little suggested readings that I gave them? Well, there's no required reading or anything. This is actually a textbook. It's way too expensive because they, you know, that's what they do. There's actually a fifth edition of this book, and it's excellent. I like it because it doesn't just tell cute stories, but it gives real meaning to them and lots of interesting commentary about all these fields we said. All kinds of disciplines come into it: history, psychology, society, religion, the meaning of existence, and all that. That you can see on the web, you can see like the publisher has a website with different outlines and some of the outlines of the contents if you want to see that. Okay, so I've taught myth many times, and there's my email. Classical Myth by Barry Powell. And I really like this topic because it includes all these different disciplines, all ways of thinking. It's about human culture, how we think, how culture works, how we define culture using stories. Since the Thanksgiving story didn't happen the way we think, why do we tell that story? To convey a certain point about harmony at the beginning between the Europeans and the natives, right? So all these different disciplines come into it, and it also relates to how to read novels and how to read movies and what messages they convey, sometimes subliminally, right? So, by the way, I do classics, and I always say this, that people say, what, you know, you do Greek, what, you know, are you from Mars? Why do you do that, you know? But all this stuff comes from the Greeks. So, if you look at all these fields I mentioned, I said it's interdisciplinary, history, psychology. All of these are Greek words, political science, right? If you look at the university, physics, almost every field has a name from ancient Greece. Everything you can major in, almost everything, is a Greek word, or Latin, a couple, because they took it from the Greeks. So that says something, that these are the roots of all kinds of ways of thinking. So a lot comes into it, okay? Has anybody ever studied ancient Greek in college or later? I have adults, I have an 80-year-old student learning Greek now. I've had, never too old. Okay, so here's a basic meaning of myth. The Greek word mythos means a story, a speech. So that's important. First, it does not mean whether it's true or not. It doesn't mean anything about truth. It's a story. So Noah's Ark is a myth. We don't, you know, people say, did it happen or not? But obviously that's not the most important thing because they're not doing ancient history. They're making a point with the story. So, and so on, right? So it's a story, and especially here, it's a traditional tale, right? Myths don't really have authors, right? The author is the culture. The culture passes it down and repeats the story because it has meaning for that culture. By the way, I think we use baseball this way, right? You hear from your dad, and I guess more and more from your moms now, about Babe Ruth, right, and Lou Gehrig, and I had all this, you know, and then you pass it down to your kids, and isn't that what Field of Dreams is about? It makes baseball into myth. It's like, remember that movie Field of Dreams? It's like paradise. They could actually come back from the dead, right? It's about bonding with his father because he heard the stories from his father. That is total myth in a few ways, right? And many people think that's the best thing about myth. About baseball, because you could be in a really boring game, but you could tell stories about other games you were at, or ones you heard about that somebody else was at that you heard was a good game, right? We repeat them because they have some meaning, that they have some importance for the culture, and you can even say they're a way cultures define themselves. They're the way cultures talk to themselves, the way you define your culture. Now, what they mean, it says that they have some importance for the culture. They have some meaning. It's important for us to have Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny and so on. But what meaning they have is very complicated. They can have many different meanings, not all as obvious as the cherry tree, don't tell a lie, right? But they have meanings about all the areas we said, all these areas of life. So, actually, I can start about Santa Claus for a minute because we have a lot to talk about today. I don't want to talk too fast, but I'll try to get a lot in. So let me just say briefly an example, Santa Claus, okay? how you can see Santa, of course it's a myth, but how you can see it several different ways. And the point here is that if you take a myth like Santa Claus, you say, what does this mean? Why do we keep telling this story? Right? What importance does it have for us? Personally, I think it has something to do with religion, but haven't totally, understood it. But you can take any story and interpret it in different ways. And so partly the meaning is what you bring to it, if you want to be a psychologist or an historian, and so on. So examples of Santa Claus. One is, you say, first of all, did this happen? Was there something in ancient times? Was there a real St. Nicholas? So we have these kind of stories, St. Nicholas gave gifts. Well, that's basically a legend. That's basically a myth right there, right? And that doesn't get us too far. That's still a story about St. Nicholas. But we can try to study it historically that way. We can also study Santa Claus historically in a different way. Santa Claus is like an ancient god, right? How is Santa Claus like a god? You can study this as the history of religion, in other words. Not just whether there's a real person or not. Is he a god, right? Well, his two, front two reindeer are Donner and Blitzen. What do Donner and Blitzen mean? Thunder and lightning. Who commands thunder and lightning? Zeus, Thor, Jupiter, the sky god, right? That's a typical ancient god called the sky god or the storm god, who's up on top of a mountain and sends bad weather like that. The Old Testament god, appears on top of a mountain, sends storms and so forth. He's like that too. Right? And when Santa Claus is all-seeing, who's all-seeing? God. Right? When he comes, is it like he knows if you've been good or bad? It's Judgment Day. Right? It's the apocalypse. Right? And it occurs at Christmas, which is the birth of the Savior who will judge you, right? So he's like an ancient deity, right? Or a modern deity, actually. Okay, and then you can also talk about, say, the iconography of Santa Claus, the way he's been depicted in art. This changes over time, right? Like some things are just made up. Like that there was that poem, The Night Before Christmas, right? That was 1834, I think, somewhere around there. Is that right? 1823. And that gave us a lot of the modern picture of Santa Claus. So it's still new. It's still being made up. And that was written by Clement Moore, who was a professor at Columbia of Greek and Oriental literature. He was a professor of myth, right? Although I actually read in a paper a few years ago, somebody thinks he didn't write it. Somebody else wrote it, but I don't know. And then we have things like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. He's making a list and checking it twice. And these were made up by songs in the 30s and 40s. You know, Rudolph didn't exist before that song. So we can add things. Santa Claus used to smoke a pipe. Does Santa smoke a pipe anymore? No. So it changes as a society changes. It reflects the society. Okay? So that could be iconography, how he's depicted, the attributes, how they change. Then suppose you are Freud, and suppose you want to read myths and say, I'm interested in psychology. Freud says it's all about, it's all about sex and your parents, according to Freud, right? So many people look at myths and that's the first thing that they might do. Now, this is only one way. That's the point here. That depends what's on your mind, what you bring to it. We add meaning, and the meaning you can turn over many ways. So what would Freud say about Santa Claus? Well, Santa's like the father. He smokes a pipe. He's all-knowing. He tells you to be good. He sets the standards. Are you good or are you bad? Father will reward you or punish you. And then when you get older, you break from Santa Claus. There's no Santa. You grow up, and that's Freud's, Oedipal breaking from the father. So he would say it's like a big father figure in the sky, which is what he said about God, by the way. What if you're a Marxist? And today we want to say everything's about economics, like the war. We want to say, oh, it's got to be about economics. And the person who started that was Karl Marx. You don't have to be a Marxist, because now we think economics is basic. Anyway, and so how would you interpret Santa Claus economically? If you want to interpret it that way, and again, the interpretation is various. It's open. Well, Marx would say, this gives you a picture of capitalism, right? Santa runs a factory. And the workers, are they paid very much?
No.
They're elves. They're not even fully grown human beings. They're put down, right? They're dehumanized. They don't get any credit. They're practically faceless and nameless. And I guess, I'm sure they're not in the union, right? And, but they're happy. They're singing all the time. They're blissfully working for Santa for nothing for themselves. And this gives you a myth to be happy with capitalism, right? Because Santa gets all the credit. Santa goes distributing the goods. If you're good, you get a sack full of presents. If you're bad, you get coal, right? So that's saying, if you're good, you can make a lot of money. If you don't make money, it's because you're bad. That's, in other words, that's saying that goods are rationally distributed. There's a logic to it, right? And does that happen in capitalism? Can bad people rise to the top? Right? Is that sometimes the point, right? So, or sometimes part of the system, right? So he would, so Marx would say this is a false ideology. It's a rosy picture to try to make you happy with this and making false claims or false ideology, he called it. Then if you're a feminist, right? Nowadays in class, the first thing people want to say is, what about women? What does it say about women, right? Maybe I'm glad nobody mentioned the Da Vinci Code yet, right? But that's all myth. That's a total myth. That's not history. You know, people want the history, but the real history is 100 times more interesting than that book, right? So, but, okay. So suppose you want a feminist reading. What about Mrs. Claus, right? She doesn't have a name. She's hardly ever mentioned. She stays home. She does domestic chores. She's not really a mother. She has no role. So this would be, you know, something to critique if you want to do feminist reading of myths. And then somebody even said, well, look at Santa's name. What if you rearrange the letters? What does that spell? Satan. So what does that mean? Does that mean anything? No. It doesn't mean anything. But maybe all these things we said don't mean anything. It depends which one you want to take and say, I like this interpretation, right? Or you could take them all in new ways. So this myths have meaning, but the meaning can go different ways. It's partly what we bring to it, how we think about it.
If you're a realist, Santa Claus is a means for selling goods.
There you go, very much. Oh, that's, yeah, very much. So that would, that's true. It's more and more commercial, right? That's right. Okay, let's see. So those are some things about myth in general. Any other thoughts about myth in general? Okay, let's see it as we go, okay? Let's start with creation stories from the ancient Near East. As it might seem like a long time ago, but it is still with us. This is the background to the Bible. Okay. Now, what do we mean by the ancient Near East? Right, Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, used to be called the Fertile Crescent, right? So that would be Sumer down here, southern Iraq and near Kuwait, Babylon, and Assyria later on, kind of in that order chronologically, from south moving up the river. And this really, I think, is the area where the major religions arose, right? So I said it was still with us. Here's a quote from William Faulkner. Faulkner said, the past is not dead. It is not even past. Right? Yeah. Okay. So we're going to say a Babylonian creation story. And this is just a chart about my little view of how it's the background of culture. Because it influenced the Hebrews who came later and were neighbors and got a lot from that. That got absorbed by Christianity and through the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. So that's kind of an Eastern line, Near Eastern. And also the ancient Near East influenced the Greeks who were taken over by the Romans. And in the Renaissance that was picked up, since Renaissance means rebirth of classical antiquity, right? And the Renaissance is when Greek and Roman and Christian really merged. And so that's our joint heritage here. And behind it all is this was ancient Near East. Okay. They have the first flood stories or accounts of creation that are comparable to Genesis. Okay? Okay, the oldest culture here was Sumer, the Sumerians. And they go back to before 3000 BC. They had the first writing even before Egypt. And we'll see something from them, but not first. First we're going to see Babylon. Babylon arose around 1800 BC. They developed an empire and conquered in this area, and they actually absorbed Sumer, and they took over many of the stories from that, which is one way the Sumerian stories were passed down. So first we're going to do the creation story from Babylon, because a poem was found on tablets of their creation story. And it was only found, I think, in the 1870s. And it was found to have earlier accounts that were like what you read in Genesis, but different and older, right? So we won't go into all the history now. But I have one more thing about Babylon here. But Hammurabi, the great lawgiver from about 1800, that's the height of called the Old Babylonian Empire. Babylonians were actually Semitic-speaking. Their language is Semitic. And they're called Akkadians, meaning Babylonians and Assyrians, right? That's one way, by the way, that is important, you know, background connected to the Jewish Bible, Old Testament. Okay, so the Babylonian creation story goes like this. Let's say what it is first. Okay, it's called, sometimes it's called the Enuma Elish. Sometimes that's used to name the poem. That's actually the first two words of the poem. And it's from 1000-something B.C. This was actually a religious hymn that they sang every New Year's, in order to affirm the order of the world. Every New Year's is like a new creation. And it celebrated their chief god, Marduk, and it describes how Marduk came to power. But first, it says how everything began and came to that point where Marduk keeps order. So it has this general pattern that you have to explain creation. What comes first, right? What comes first? Well, if we have the Big Bang, what came first? What was it that banged? You need some kind of blob, right? You need some kind of primordial mass, right? Something like a big mass, something undifferentiated. Like some people have primal waters or a primal mass. And of course, it's hard to think beyond that. Where did that come from, right? So the common pattern is that you have something, chaos. You can call that chaos. There's something undifferentiated, a big blob of something, and it evolves into where parts of the universe split off. You get rivers and the earth and sky and planets, and eventually you create order, and the universe is ordered the way it is now with orderly rotations of heavenly bodies and the seasons and the years coming around. And that's called cosmos. What does cosmos mean? The universe. And especially the ordered universe. Do you know what word we get from cosmos? Another word, much different. Cosmetics comes from cosmos. Because you adorn yourself with cosmetics. So cosmos means the ordered universe. And the pattern in these creation stories is from chaos to cosmos. From disorder to order. Okay? And then the one God rules and keeps order. Okay? Is the whole theme of this poem, which was their religious poem. Okay. So first you have to explain the creation of everything. And another... please.
Excuse me. You said one God, but the Babylonians worshipped a lot of gods.
Oh, yeah, of course. We're going to see.
One head God.
Right. Okay. Oh, sure. They're all polytheism. Even the Jews had polytheism before Yahweh cult, you know, came to dominate. It was kind of edited out of the Bible, right? And it's actually they're polytheistic, they're anthropomorphic gods, they're like people. But what you have is the gods don't come first and create everything. That's a big difference. They explain the creation of things, and that's cosmogony, the birth of the universe. And so certain things come first, and then the gods are born. So the gods are part of the world. They're not creators, they're part of the world, which is more of a message about nature, natural forces the gods represent. And then you have different generations, and we'll say the story in a minute, you have several generations of gods who battle it out about which one will rule. That's a common pattern which is later picked up by the Greeks. Okay, so it explains cosmogony, the birth of the universe. That then comes theogony, the birth of the gods. And then it also explains cosmology, which is how the universe works. Why it rains, you know, why planets go around, whatever, about the actual workings, the logic, the explanation of. Okay? Okay, so it starts out, and of course we still have this, right? We're still not sure about the very beginning. So we said myth comes to fill in the unknown, the darkness. Maybe we don't want this darkness at the beginning of time or the beginning of the universe, right? And we're still, of course, in this country, we're still debating about that, right? Do we want the ancient story or do we want science, right? So we have both, okay? Or do we want turtles, right? Okay, so here's the story finally, okay? It starts out like this. When on high, heaven was not yet named, that means it didn't exist. Nor was the hard ground below called by name. The earth didn't exist. There was nothing but primordial Apsu, the begetter. Okay, Apsu is male fresh water.
Male?
Male.
Male water?
Sure. Why not? And you need males and females. And Mother Tiamat, she's the female water. You've got the mixed together the primordial waters, and she's salt water. She who gave birth to everything, the mother. The waters of Apsu and Tiamat were mingled together as a single body. And they're actually having intercourse and giving birth to children, but they're still inside the waters because they're mingled together. They're not separated yet. The gods took form within them, right? So the first thing you have is primordial waters. And they are the oldest gods. They have several generations of gods. And we'll go down maybe four generations to these characters, Anu and Ea. And this is a story of several generations of deities. And it goes from kind of wilder, where these are like natural forces, primordial waters, and these become kind of wicked as the story goes. These are the wilder, older forces, and they get increasingly better until the good guy wins and kind of puts them down. So, but you have this story called The Succession in Heaven of different rulers fighting for the rule. Okay? The Greeks have that too. They probably copied this. Okay, so the next significant one is Anu Ea, a few generations down. Anu is the sky, also called An, A-N in other languages in the area.
Uh-huh. Okay,
you're saying this is Babylonian. Yeah.
Okay, and then you're going back. Is it part of the Epic of Gilgamesh?
No, it's not. We'll save the Epic of Gilgamesh. I hope we have time, as much as we have time for today. We'll save that after. We'll see. We'll see that. No. This is a poem found on certain tablets.
Right.
And it's Babylonian. This is not necessarily something they took from the Sumerians.
But it's
Canadian
one?
Yeah, sure. Right. So it's Akkadian Semitic language from Babylon.
Yeah, I understood what An was, but what did you say Ea was?
Oh, good question. Well, we didn't say yet, but Ea is also called Enki, E-N-K-I, because there were a few cultures with the same gods in different languages, kind of like Greek and Latin later on. And Ea is a god of the earth who is, he's associated with drinking water, and he's a trickster. You know, many myths have a trickster figure, right? He's more associated with people. That's, I think, the significant thing here. He's kind of a trickster in being with the earth and drinking water and clever like that. He has more relations with people, which is, by the way, part of the progression here. Because here you have these natural forces. Here's this guy that you see, here's more with people, and he, you know, that increases. There's a progression. So these gods, this later generation, they are dancing and making noise. But there's a generation conflict. Remember this from the 60s, the generation gag? You don't hear that anymore, right? They give Apsu insomnia. He can't sleep, so he wants to destroy them. So he creates a monster named Mumu, and they fight, the older gods fight the younger gods. So, of course, calling Dr. Freud, the younger gods want to overthrow the older gods. And the older gods come to look worse, since he's with this monster who wants to destroy the younger ones, so it's made to seem progress again. And Ea takes charge. He's the smart one. And he defeats Apsu and Mumu. He kills Apsu, and he seems to be kind of trodden underground. Although the ground doesn't exist yet, but he ends up later on seeming to be under the earth. We get a word from Apsu. That's one of the few words from Sumerian, because his name goes back to Sumerian that was older than this. Abyss seems to come from his name. Right? And Mumu's tied up. And then it comes down that these gods want to rule. But then Tiamat, the mother, turns against them. And so then they have another conflict with Tiamat. So again, it's younger versus older. And Tiamat gets a new husband named Kingu. And she gives him the tablets of destiny, which gives him power of the, over the universe. Is this kind of patriarchal, right? That it has to be the male, right? And in the story, I mean. And she creates these different monsters. Snakes with horns, dragons, scorpion men, lion demons, fish men, bull men, devils, right? And you see this Mesopotamian art. So Tiamat looks bad. She makes these monsters, and Kingu, who kind of looks like a bad guy, although doesn't say that much about him. So here's the thing about Tiamat. Now, she's the older one taking on the younger ones. Now, everybody's interested in kind of the gender question. Were there female gods at first? Were they a lot better? Did men mess everything up, right? Well, the myths are not that simple. History is not that simple, I don't think. I mean, I could say a lot about that, but not right now. There's a lot to say about that, and think about it. But if you look at these figures, Tiamat is the mother goddess, the waters. She's not all good, right? She turns against the younger ones. And that's many of these figures are ambiguous. It's not that women are all good in the myths and men are not. Because, say Tiamat represents the earth, right? The mother that gives life, the earth, nature giving life, right? Does that mean she's all good? Well, nature gives life, but does nature give other things besides life? Like hurricanes, right? And death. Everything that's born dies. And by the way, fertility goddesses are always goddesses of death as well, like Persephone, who's the queen of Hades. So that's the other side of it, right? So Tiamat, if someone wanted to look at Tiamat that way, because I know this is what everybody's interested in now, besides those 10 things we said myths mean, many people want this one, to look at it this way, Tiamat is ambiguous. So to use the myth as evidence for what really happened in that kind of move from female to male, that's a very complicated question about what actually happened. Okay, and the myths are ambiguous about that. So that comes into it. Okay, so then Ea gives birth to Marduk, and he's going to be the champion of the younger gods. And he's going to be the hero of the whole poem, like we said. Marduk is born fully developed. He has four sides to his face, four eyes, four ears. That's funny, you'd think 80 ears, I guess. But fire shoots from his mouth. He saw all that was. He was born fully developed, quote, perfect, a god twice over, okay? Of course, it helps to have four faces, right? To see every direction, of course. And the four winds are his toys when he's a baby. Well, he's when he's newly born, but he wasn't a baby. He was fully developed when he was born. And so he's making a lot of noise playing with these winds for his toys. And the other gods complain. And Tiamat complains that her waters are being disturbed because she's still the primal waters. So Tiamat and Kingu and these monsters that she creates, they fight against Marduk. I'll just go back here. So that's the younger generation against the older in a battle of the gods. And Marduk defeats them in a battle. The other gods, older the generation before him, they say he can have absolute power if he wins for them and defeats Tiamat and these monsters. So this becomes a story of the forces of order, cosmos, trying to defeat chaos and monsters. And Marduk is armed with lightning and the winds. He rides a chariot. So he's the storm god. He battles Tiamat. He drives a storm into her mouth and puffs up her belly and it bursts. Now she's the mother, right? So isn't that a pregnancy image? You know, violent, bizarre inversion of that is the way he defeats her. Hi.
This one is, let's see, Lexus out here with the lights on. Plate number 6176. I don't know if there's anybody in this room. It's in the handicap parking. No. Lexus. It's a Lexus car, but has the lights on, so.
Okay.
Okay, nobody here. Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm taking a cross in ancient, in that era.
Good.
And there was, wasn't there a Hebrew prophet who had a vision that looked a lot like Marduk? Seems to me I remember that from the reading.
I don't know it.
There were four faces and...
Well, there's Daniel, there's a beast with four, made of four metals in the book of Daniel. That could be it. That's actually the latest book written of the Old Testament.
Okay.
The latest parts of that are from 164 B.C. That's the latest composed. It's not the latest in the order of the way it's printed, but the latest written Old Testament text. And that actually relates to some other Greek stories next time, actually. I'm going to throw that in next time. But not with this. I mean, maybe with this, but I don't know about that. Uh-huh.
Up to this point, then, there's really no life form, as we know it.
There's no people. Right. Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's right. The earth. So the earlier deities are natural forces like the waters. Marduk is going to create these elements of the world as we know it, right, coming up. And there's still no people yet. So it's making important theological points. One is that the world is not made for people. Another is that God still controls the world. Nature comes before the gods and before people. Uh-huh. Yes.
It occurs to me that all of these myths were written in languages.
Sure.
Language is also something that developed.
Of course.
And was more primitive earlier. What do we know about how sophisticated the language used to tell these myths was?
Well, it's very sophisticated, but we can't go into all that now. But the language is actually much more complicated in earlier times than it is today. We're becoming simpler and dumber, you know, nowadays. You know, with writing and television and democracy, makes you simpler your thought. You know, like I can write a lot more complicated than I can talk, and we, you know, this is the process of language. Greek was much more developed before they had even had writing.
I was more interested in what was missing from language.
Oh, I can't go into language now, but I don't know Akkadian language anyway. So with Greek later we can say, but let's still tie it to myth. Okay.
This is a creation myth. Are you presenting it as the first creation myth?
Oh, good question. Well, it's not really the first ever, but it's the first full one. It's the first one we have in a full form. And so actually the first one I know of, yes. I mean, we have Sumerian literature and other things, but there's no fully developed poem like this, as rich as this.
The Hebrew calendar goes back almost 6,000 years.
Yeah.
Which would predate this.
No.
Possibly
no, Hebrew is much, much later. The calendar means when they say the world was created. The Bible was written between, most of it between, in the first millennium. The Bible is all from the first millennium B.C., 1,000 on. This is second millennium B.C., this is the 1000s B.C. A little unknown what the exact date is. But I'll say this coming up, we'll say the Bible account of creation when it was written. It's written a lot later and people would be surprised how late it is. The Bible account of creation we have was edited in 450 B.C. We have the version that was made in 450 B.C. is what we have now for the first five books of the Bible. That's very late, but the authors are from the 8th century and the 6th century of the creation account in Genesis. And there are three or four hands, since there were two authors and then it was edited. People would be very surprised. It's not the first book ever. People who, you know, pound the Bible, you know, don't study it like that. You know, they might think it's the first book ever and the account from the sky, but it's not that simple, right? Because it has this historical background. Even if, you know, if you believe it or not, it's good to know that background. It just helps your belief if you want to go that way. And I think it would be essential to know when it was written, who wrote it, and all that, if we make a big deal out of it today. Okay, so we'll say something about that. We'll come up to that. Okay, so let's say this story. So Marduk wins. He defeats Tiamat and bursts her in this violent image. He defeats Kingu and takes the tablets of destiny from him. And then this is where you get our world being formed. Okay, there's a little picture. Notice Marduk is more human. He's got lightning bolts. And he defeats Tiamat, who's a monster. So this is the progress of order defeating chaos. And he splits the waters. He splits Tiamat like a clamshell, it says. And that's splitting the waters to make the space in between where our world is. So there's waters above and below. This is in the Bible, by the way. In Hebrew, it says God split the waters. So fundamentalists would have to maintain that there are waters above the sky and all the way below. An Egyptian had the sun traveling on a boat. Why is that? Around the waters, right? So this relates to all those cultures. And that's the same waters.
Where does that particular
article come from? Oh, that I'm not sure. That I can't remember, actually. Sorry about that. This is all from Babylon, Babylonian archaeology of Babylon. I can't remember now.
The splitting of the waters, does that relate to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that comes in, that's right. That comes in, all those things come now. Because out of her eyes come the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. They flow forth. So that would be down here. They flow out of her, right? It says they flow out of her eyes. So that means she's down there. Exactly. And he creates, in that space, he creates our universe. The sun, moon, stars, heavenly bodies, clouds, wind, and rain. The two rivers flow out. And so Marduk creates that order. Now, in most stories, you need to hold up the upper waters or they'll fall down on your head, right? Who do the Greeks have at that point holding everything up? They put Atlas there for that very reason, because they have a story of this kind of splitting. In the Bible, it says God split the waters into upper and lower waters, and he put a firmament there. That's the King James. Well, who knows what a firmament is? Well, that word just means something firm, okay? A firm thing. But that's not the Hebrew. And other translations say a partition or something. So I think they're kind of guessing. They're just saying he put something up to hold up the waters. Maybe it was a column. Who knows? I don't think the Hebrew is that specific. Uh-huh.
In most stories of creation that I'm familiar with, water is always the prominent element. Now, what is the significance of that? It's a life force?
Yeah, very much. Well, it makes sense they would come first. That's right. Life depends on water. There's more water than land, right? They knew that there was water all the way around. You know, if they know Mesopotamia and, say, Greece and North Africa, right, or the Mediterranean, everywhere they knew around that, it was surrounded by water. They didn't know what was beyond the Atlantic or the Indian Ocean, right? So also, life depends on water and rain, right? Water from the sky, that could be the way of explaining rain, that it comes down from these upper waters. And you need that for life. You need the sky to fertilize the earth, right? And if the Greeks even had some evolutionary views that animals started in water and then moved to land. But that's Greek thought a lot later when they get philosophy, 600 BC. And actually now we know people's bodies are mostly water, right? But they didn't know that. Yeah, the life depends on water. Okay, so then there's still no people yet. So where do people come from? Marduk makes people from the blood and bones of Kingu. Kingu was the last husband of Tiamat, who was the bad guy he defeated. So what does that mean if people are made from the blood and bones of Kingu? Is that positive about human nature? Right? It's some kind of monster. And it's saying, of course, you're not from heaven. You are of matter, right? Like usually people are made from clay and dust. It just says from the blood and bones. Why did he make people? He made people so that they could serve the gods. The gods have to be happy. Gods do not want to work. But gods have to eat. Gods have a little problem because they have bodies. They're anthropomorphic, right? Shaped like people. And they were not totally all-powerful. They were part of nature. They were born. And they make people to serve the gods. People work and make the food to feed the gods. So the gods can be free. How do you feed the gods?
Offering.
Yeah, a sacrifice, right? So then people built this temple And this is called the ziggurat. That's the Mesopotamian temple. You build a mound to worship on top the sky god. And actually these, some of these have been bombed in recent wars over there, right? And that is saying that the gods are up here, people are down below. People's lot is very low. It's very pessimistic about that. So people then have to build something to try to bridge the gap with gods and appeal to the gods. So you build a ziggurat, and now people start to come in to the story. So that explains the way things are now. And then people have to worship Marduk. Why? Because he maintains order. He maintains order. He's the one keeping the upper waters from crashing on you. He's the one keeping Kingu from coming back, or Tiamat, right? Or these other monsters. Every year they worshipped him and told this poem at New Year's to maintain the order, right? And so it gives a reason for piety. It says a lot about the human condition, that life is hard for people. People are the subject of nature and floods and hurricanes. And actually the flood story is one of the things that comes next, right? But I think we should take a break now, right? And there's a number of these that were excavated, these ziggurats. Okay? Actually, we'll say the creation of people, the flood story of Gilgamesh as much as we have time for, okay? Do you want to take a 10-minute break?
Sure.
Good. Okay. So, a few people asked, can we have questions at the end? And enough people asked that, so let's do that, okay? So let's say creation of people, summarize this a little bit, say how the Hebrew account is different, but similar also. And then something about the flood stories, since this kind of goes chronologically, that these gods came first and then people, and things are hard for people. The flood is part of that, the relations between people and gods, how the world is hard for people. Okay, so people are not made from heavenly stuff. People are not like gods, right? We saw this story that they're made from the blood and bones of a monster named Kingu. Well, in the other stories, they're typically people are made from earth. There's a Sumerian story, which is older, the oldest Mesopotamian culture, that two deities, Enki, who's the trickster, he's the same as Aiea that we saw, and Ki, K-I, who's an earth woman, they fashioned people out of clay to be servants of the gods, to provide for the gods' needs. Because the gods did not have enough to eat, especially after female gods came into existence. It says, right? Gods were multiplying, so... And I actually did some research about sacrifice, and I said sacrifice... was thought to feed the gods. Why do people slaughter animals and say, here, God, I'm giving you a gift. Be grateful because I'm giving you something. And even in the Bible, by the way, it talks about Yahweh consuming these. We have a professor at Drew who wrote a book about how many calories God ate based on all the animals sacrificed to him. Yeah, not me. It's in the theological school. That's what they do in theology. So this story explains more that they make people, but they got drunk, and they deformed some of them, and it's a little story about why some people are born with birth defects. And that would be called an etiology. Some myths give an explanation of the cause of something. An etiology is an important thing myths do. And there's another Babylonian epic called Atrahasis, is that gods made people from mud to serve the gods. So this is saying something lowly about people, right? If you're from mud, that means you're from, or clay, that means you're from dirt, ashes to ashes, right? They didn't think you're going to be saved, you know. It's very pessimistic. Well, Hebrew is both similar and different. Because in the Hebrew scriptures, right, in the book of Genesis, there are actually two accounts of the creation of people. There are two different accounts. Because there are two different authors. In fact, there were more than two because there was somebody else who edited it. And the two main authors are called J and E. And this was all studied by German scholars in the late 1700s because J calls God one name, Yahweh, and they call it J because that's in German for Yahweh, as in Jehovah with the J. And E calls God a different name, Elohim, which means Lord. Okay, and they have different theologies. Two different strands woven together at one point combined. So the older one is the J author, from the 8th century B.C. This is the Adam and Eve story. God made Adam, and the word Adam means dust. Adama means dust. So that's in line with these Mesopotamian stories, which is the background, and they were the neighbors, and they got a lot from those older cultures like the Babylonians, who got things from the Sumerians. But there's another account which actually occurs earlier in the text, but we know it's written later because it's a developed theology, when it says God made people in the image of God. That's saying you're God-like. That's the opposite of being from the dust. That means you're God-like, and that's what people want to be, right? They want to be eternal and immortal, like, although that the Bible isn't even sure about that in the Old Testament, right? But that's a different theology. People are like God, and the two different accounts have other differences, like the order of people in relation to plants, the order of creation. Right, in Adam and Eve, the plants come later, and Adam rules the plants, whereas in E, people in the image of God, the plants are made first, and things like that. They're two different accounts. So the same thing with the Hebrew creation story, that it in Genesis, the Bible account, it has similar steps as we saw. There's some kind of waters mingled together. God separates the waters into the upper and lower waters. Actually, what came very first? A formless mass, darkness, chaos, right? So there's disorder, formless, and you develop order or form. So it's called, that first step is called fluid chaos. In Hebrew, tehom. This book I use, he claims that tehom is related to the word tiamat, the female primordial waters. I'm really not sure if that works. I think it's a guess. Maybe not literally true. But there's some stage like that, your primal whatever, blob, and things get split off and differentiated from that. It has this kind of account. In other words, some kind of progression of creation. God separates the upper and lower waters. After that, that was like splitting Tiamat. God puts up something to hold it up. It's called a firmament or a partition in different translations. And You also get some monsters like the Leviathan, the sea monster, or the whale that swallows Jonah. Sometimes you get these monsters who represent earlier stages of creation that might rear up at some time. But the big difference is the role of God, of course, right? This is the big innovation. Because you don't have all the stages of the different gods. God creates everything at once, right? And God is outside of creation, right? This is what the Hebrews did, that God is transcendent, God is outside time, God creates everything, whereas in those older accounts, the world is born and then the gods are born, right? And the gods are more part of nature there. So this is the transcendent, the idea of eternal, and of course monotheism. Although now we know, you can read books about polytheism in early Israel. This traces that in the Bible. God says, get rid of all those other gods, just me. And that won out, and all the other ones got edited out. You know, they didn't get their own book in Hebrew. And God actually had a wife in early Israel, Asherah, right? So people talk about that more now, and you can read a couple of good books about that if you want to know. Okay, so this is a developed theology. It was written to stress God's creation and a whole different role of a transcendent God, which, of course, made it possible later on to develop the idea of people can become like God and become immortal and outside time. That was, you know, necessary for that, to have that idea. Okay, so when was this written? Was there really some influence from Babylon and Mesopotamia on the Bible? So this is what we were saying before. The Bible is actually later than people think. The Israelites first come into the land about 1000 B.C. That's the first kings, right? David founded Jerusalem right around then, and his son Solomon. And the Old Testament books are all written about 800 to 146 B.C. There might be a couple of psalms that are really by David, which would be older. But there are ones that claim to be David that are not, actually. And then, so you had these two authors, J and E, and actually a couple of other ones, P and D, you said. And then some editor, and there's a good book called Who Wrote the Bible by Friedman, which explains this, and a very readable book. And so if that took shape in 450, that's contemporary with the Greek tragedies and Socrates, right? So, and also the Hebrews were at first nomads in the land west of the Euphrates River, outside of Babylon. They were in touch with that. Abraham came from Ur, right? Abraham's family came from Ur. Where is Ur? Sumer, right? And Babylonian and Assyrian are Semitic languages like Hebrew, so there's a clear older transmission from all that. Okay. And same thing with the flood stories. The flood stories come next in the story of creation, that the gods came. The gods are kind of natural forces. The gods made people. People are very lowly and serve the gods. So life is hard, and the gods might be angry and send bad things like floods, because nature can be harsh. The gods aren't all good and all perfect. They're not there to make everything good for us, right? So this is where the flood story comes, the relationship between gods and people. And the flood story is actually much older than Noah. Archaeologists found this actually in 1872, and that's a good story itself. So there was a British scholar named George Smith working in the British Museum, and they got these tablets from excavations. He saw that one tablet talked about a great flood. Sounded like the Noah story, but much older. So he went over there and excavated, and amazingly enough, he found the rest of the tablets with the rest of the story. It's very rare to find what you want. And, right? And he found the Babylonian creation story we had. That's sometimes called the Enuma Elish, shorthand for that story we saw. He's the one who found that and the flood story. So this showed the flood goes back much older. And, I mean, I would argue, since I might as well say what I think, that there's a transmission from here to the Noah story, and then to the Greeks, all these flood stories are passed down. And you can kind of see that as a literary borrowing. Okay, so the oldest one is from Sumer. This is the 3rd millennium B.C., the 2000-something B.C. It goes like this. The gods decide to destroy mankind. They're going to bring a flood and wipe people out. This is common in these stories. The gods can hate people. The gods can be angry and wipe people out. And I would say this would be like the gods saying, we don't like creation. We're going to turn the clock back to the primordial waters, right? Return chaos and start over again, right? So in other words, that is saying there's some theme there. And that's a little different than saying maybe this really happened, right? That's a different question. Because there are these kind of themes about the gods and chaos and everything else, okay? So the gods are going to destroy people, but Enki, the one god, who's the same as Ea, E-A, who's a trickster, more related to people, he's also associated with drinking water, the earth, people again. He likes one guy, decides to save one guy, Zeusudra. And he tells him to build a boat, and he lands on a mountain, and the mountain has a certain name, and nobody knows where the mountain is, and then the Enki transports him to Dilmun and makes him live like a god, and his name means long life, meaning he got to survive, he gets a type of immortality. Most people didn't get this, but a god can pick you up and give it to you very rarely. Special dispensation, right? Which would just highlight that most people don't get that, right? It happened once, and that's it. Dilmun is the original paradise, actually. Dilmun is an island of the gods, beyond the waters. Okay, if you're in Sumer, you go east through the Gulf, and it's all waters out there, and there's some island, Dilmun, which is a garden of the gods. Do you know what the word for garden is? Paradisos. Paradise means garden, right? In Persian and Greek, actually, that's what it comes from. And that's what it says, the Garden of the Gods. It's like a Garden of Eden, you live with the gods. Archaeologists think Dilmun is Bahrain. That would be the first paradise, Bahrain. Okay. So, then, there, okay, there are a couple of others. Okay, the first two I want to say right now, we'll see something later from that. There's another Babylonian one called the Myth of Atrahasis, about 1700 BC. The gods have to work constantly. So they revolt, and this is when they create people from mud to serve the gods. But then people are too noisy, people are growing, so they want to reduce the population of people. Look how arbitrary it is, right? It reminds you of, you know, 9/11 or the Hurricane Katrina, right? This is what the world is like for people. And so the gods send plague, drought, famine, flood, and they wipe out people. But they save one guy, Atrahasis. So that's another Noah-type figure. His name means exceeding wise. That means he was good and rewarded for being good, wise. They tell him to build a boat. He puts on it his family and animals, and they're the only survivors. But there's a little problem. Now there's no people, and the gods have nobody to work for them. The gods suffer from the flood also. The gods are starving. So they have to make new people, but they make a compromise. We don't want those people to grow so noisy again and bother us. So they make some people with birth defects. Some people can have children. Some people never mate. And some babies die young. And this is supposed to be the etiology to explain that the gods do send that to reduce the population. And notice it's all very pessimistic about the human condition in the world. Right, people at the mercy of all these forces that can just fall down on you from the sky and from the gods. Okay. Well, the Hebrew story, of course, is very similar because it was clearly transmitted from these other cultures. It's passed down. That's pretty obvious in scholarship, although I guess it hasn't entered popular consciousness yet, and some people might, you know, people try to argue, people want to, you know, there's different ways you can say that and so forth. But here's the Hebrew story. It makes it more moral. The Lord saw the wickedness of man, meaning mankind, people. He was sorry he had made people. I will blot out people. So again, he'll wipe them out. The Old Testament God is not always, you know, a good God. But it's made to be a moral failure by people. It stresses people's wickedness. People deserve it. I guess that actually takes away from the point I just made. That it's not saying God is arbitrary, but that people deserve it. It's justice, right? It brings out that message that God is just, I suppose, right? And, of course, God brings the flood, and the message is be good so God doesn't do that again. And the rainbow appears as the covenant. If you keep piety to God, he will help you, right? But it makes a more moral point, more theological message. Now, here's something, though, on the side here, in this little sidebar.
I don't know if this is on point, but when did wickedness come into this flow? I mean, the concept of wickedness.
Well, in the flood stories, this is really the first one. Because this is changing it to a moral message. So actually, I just realized it kind of changes it from God being arbitrary to people are wicked, people deserve it, it's going to be just, it's going to be good for you. You should be good, I'm going to give you a time out, make you stay in your room until you're good. Right, the good father or something, right? So it's much more of a moral message and a pious message than the earlier ones. This is a change with this theology we said that came in with the change in the creation story and the glory of God in Hebrew, whereas still it's similar to the older ones, but the important change, which is after all what went out over time, right? Okay, and one more thing there, actually, is that Noah then lands on a mountain. What's the name of the mountain in the Noah story? Mount Ararat. Now, there are several stories, and there are several mountains. So, can you go to Mount Ararat and find Noah's Ark, right? It's very difficult. First, nobody knows where Mount Ararat is, right? There were teams of people from Texas, where else, going there, and it's covered with ice, and they go to this place, and everybody claims they saw things underground, which are totally made up, because nothing has ever been seen. And I'll show you the next slide first. These people went looking, and they said, well, we found no evidence. But because there's no evidence, we still think it could be there, and we still think it's true. This is not logic, right? But we're like these people, sorry. Okay, so, right? And I lived in Texas, so I can say. But the thing is, they go to this mountain, and we don't even know what mountain Mount Ararat is in the story. The place now that they look at was designated in the Middle Ages. Somebody said, I think that's the mountain, and they built a church called the Church of the Ark or the Monastery of the Ark, something like that. And it was only identified as, and given the label Mount Ararat in the middle of 900 or somewhere around there in the Middle Ages. So we don't know. Plus, if there are these older stories that you could argue originated in Sumer and Babylon and were passed down, well, the mountain changes because every culture tells some mountain, you know, that's on their horizon from their point of view. Right? The edge of their world. It moves. Right? So, you'd have to look for all those mountains. We don't even know where those mountains are, you know, because somebody's talking about Afghanistan or somebody's talking about, you know, some limits of the world they knew. So, that's one reason I don't think you can really prove this historically, and that's obviously much more in the story about the relations of gods and people than ancient history and what geology was like and the things people try to do. Since the first thing people do is try to prove the flood because this story is important for our religion. But how can you prove the flood using science? I mean, can you prove that God spoke to Noah? Could you ever prove, you know, that?
Isn't the flood story an almost universal story? American
yeah.
Indians, I believe, have a flood story. The Chinese?
A little bit, there are. Well, now this gets into the interesting thing, how you take these. Many people will say, well, there must have been a great flood because there are many stories. I don't think that myself. I think people make things up all the time. We said water came first a lot of times. These are stories about reverting from civilization to disaster, right? Because people are always afraid that a great disaster can come and wipe out your fields. Or in Sumer, where these flood stories started, they depended on irrigation. It was very marshy. Civilization depended on irrigating and having controlled irrigation, which is how the states arose, by the way. They needed manpower to organize irrigation, and that's how kings and states developed, the first states in Sumer, 3,400 BC, 3,000 BC. So it was so important to control the water supply. And the fear was, well, if the dikes burst, if the state doesn't keep control, you're back to chaos and all hell breaks loose, or all Hades breaks loose, right? So I think it's this fear, right? I think, or the rain can come, you know, floods do happen. I think people can make it up. I think it's so far back, we can never prove it, even if we wanted to, it's so far back. Oh, that's right. Well, that turned out to be alluvial deposit from the rivers. What happened was an archaeologist named Woolley went there and excavated Ur. There's good things in Philadelphia. There's beautiful objects in the University Museum in Philadelphia. And he found about 10 feet of deposit. And he said, this is the flood. And now we, because that's what you want. People want the myths to be empirical. Like, we want Santa Claus to eat the milk and cookies. But there's much more in the myths, right, than these facts. So it turns out that's natural alluvial deposit. Actually, by the way, one of the archaeologists there was Agatha Christie's husband, who was an important Mesopotamian archaeologist. You know, a couple of her books are set there. So there's a question whether it really happened. This is interesting to look at, but it would be very hard, I think, to prove. But it just shows that we can think that way. And the main thing is to think about how we think about it. If we think that way, what assumptions are we making? Or if we look at the literary tradition, which is there strongly, what does that say, right? Because, you know, when we want to prove it, it shows how important these ancient stories are to our culture today, right? I'll just go back here. There's actually another, so that's, let's look at that as an open question about how different ways to think about it and different ways to approach myth, historical or not. With these particular stories, you might say there was something in Sumer, that something might have really happened there, like you're suggesting with the silt, and then it passed down to these other places, right? So that's, because there's a transmission in this area, you still can't tell what originally happened, if you wanted to look into that. Okay, well, with the The Hebrew account, and by the way, people always tell me, well, Noah's not really Hebrew, you know. But he is there, you know. He's in their story. In this account, there's the Bible account. But there's also another version found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Do you know something about the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found in the late 40s in jars, right? And they have older texts. They have versions of the Hebrew scriptures that are sometimes different than the ones in the Bible, which became the canon and got edited sometimes. So they have a different flood story, which is a lot wilder, that says, when we said the God saw the wickedness of mankind in the Old Testament, it explains how people were wicked. God had sons who came down to earth and married mortal women. And their children were giants. And the Bible actually mentions these giants, Nephilim. But they became cannibals. They went bad. And this is why God punished them for being wicked. It gives more detail, and that was edited out of the Bible. It was too wild. And you don't want to talk about multiple sons of God at that point. It really creates a little issue about what they are. Later they were said to be fallen angels or something, right? But it's supposed to be monotheism, so it might be embarrassment. So the Dead Sea Scrolls preserve this alternative. And funny enough, the Greeks have a flood story. And in the Greek flood story, people are wicked. Why are people wicked? There's a king who's a cannibal, and Zeus punishes them. So the cannibal really was one ancient line. And by the way, when there's a Greek flood story, this is one reason to think it's made up. Because they obviously got it from these Mesopotamian stories. Have you ever been to Greece? Did you have any rain there? Would it ever flood in Greece? Would you ever dream of a flood in Greece? You would never think of it. You're praying for drinking water. It's parched. It cannot rain all summer. There's hardly any navigable rivers. Very funny, because most major cities are built, almost everyone is built on a river, but not in Greece, right? There aren't any. There are really practically none. So that's part of the story that you have from Sumer to Babylon, Akkadians, Hebrew Bible, and the Greeks, and then the Romans got it from them. Okay, so now let's talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh. This is the first hero story. What you get next are the first generations of people who are heroes. What is a hero? Well, they're usually demigods, right? And then you get more of the relations between gods and people. Sometimes gods, you know, take your liking and have affairs with people. And Zeus is famous for this in the Greek. And you get kind of a transition between gods and people. We're saying people down here, they're made of dirt. In between, you have demigods, which is part of the move from gods to demigods to people like us. Okay? So these demigods, of course, they're part god. Gilgamesh is actually two-thirds divine and one-third mortal. I don't know how that happens. And a mathematician told me it's impossible, even if you counted up all the ancestors, you can't, you know, they're all twos, right? They're multiples of two. So his, okay, let's say something about Gilgamesh is. It's really the first great hero story, and some of the Greek stories copy this a little bit. And it's a fantastic story. Have you ever read this story?
Yeah.
Well, now it's in translations, and now it's part of the canon. Now they'll read it in English classes, and you go to a college bookstore, and there'll be piles of this. But that's very new. That's 20 years or less that's been out there. You know John Gardner, an American novelist? He did a literary version here. And this is probably the best one to read. Okay. So Gilgamesh was a real king of Uruk, which is a city in Sumer, because they had city-states. Each city had its own king. He was a real king around this time, 2700 B.C. or 2500 B.C. That's another spelling, Erech, for the same city. And he became legendary, so they would write poems about him and pass down the exploits of Gilgamesh. Well, over time, these grew for about 2,000 years, and it became the bestseller, the main epic, throughout the Near East. That the Sumerians had these poems, then the Babylonians came and developed an empire like Hammurabi and conquered Sumer. And then they took the story of Gilgamesh and put it in Babylonian, and they told these stories, and like it worked into an epic at one point. It became a longer story. And So you find this in all these places in different languages. And the main one, if you buy the paperbacks, we're mostly reading the last version from 620, I think. Yeah, the 620s BC, that was found in Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. Because archaeologists found the library of Ashurbanipal, who maybe you've heard of from the Bible, right? And he had a great library. He collected books and classics. And he, imagine that, a ruler who promotes classics, right? And he had a version of the Epic of Gilgamesh on 12 tablets. And that's the first version. It's actually the last one, okay? This is like 2,000 years, okay? And by this time, this is around when the Greeks would have known it, because there seemed to be borrowings within Greek from this. Okay. So Gilgamesh was a demigod. His mother was the moon goddess. That's a pretty good connection. And his father was a man, the king, a mortal. So he's two-thirds divine and one-third mortal, it says, right? Maybe his mother was twice as important because she was a goddess, right? And this is the hero's position. Like Achilles, right? What is Achilles? Who were his parents, do you know? In the Iliad. Achilles' mother is a goddess, a sea nymph, and his father is a mortal. Achilles is half and half a demigod. The whole problem is, am I a god or am I a mortal? The hero is caught in between. So the hero wants to do great things, to be greater than other humans, because they know they're a demigod. They want to push the limits of humanity, do great achievements. And they have to face death. Are they going to be mortal? Can they live like a god? So, but that's how hero stories become stories about everybody. Right? Because it talks about human life. Okay, which way are we going to go? Up or down? To heaven or to death? Right? Okay. So, let's start the story. Okay, there's the map of Uruk down here. This would be Sumer originally, and then it got passed up to the other cultures that succeeded that. Okay, I'll give you the preface here. Proem means the preface. It starts out like this. The man who saw everything to the ends of the earth, who experienced everything, considered all. He saw what was hidden. He disclosed the undisclosed. He brought back a story of times before the flood. Antediluvian, right? He went on a long journey. He was wearied. He rested. Everything he did, he engraved on a monument made of stone. And the book here compares to the beginning of the Odyssey, but Odysseus' journeys. So it says a lot there. He went to the ends of the earth. That's about reaching the limits. What's beyond? Can you go past the limits? Right? So it's a journey of discovery, learning. He brought back a story of times before the flood. A flood story comes in here, we'll see that. And then he came home and wrote it down for people to learn from. It says he wrote it on stone. Okay, so all these great themes of the hero's journey, which, by the way, Joseph Campbell talks about quite a bit, and he got it from Carl Jung, by the way, the psychologist who said people are on spiritual quests. So Gilgamesh has this kind of quest, but what he finds out is, it's a knockout, it's great stuff. Okay, so Gilgamesh at first is a king. At first he's a bad king. He is abusive. When people get married, he has to have sex with the woman first. You know this existed in the Middle Ages, in Latin, the Latin West. And the gods make this creature in order to take on Gilgamesh and counter Gilgamesh. The gods make Enkidu out of clay. Enkidu is a wild beast man who's living with the animals. So you have a little nature versus civilization theme here if you want to do literary analysis like that. And that's throughout the story. But what happens is the farmers complain that Enkidu and the beasts are disrupting their fields and their flocks. So Gilgamesh traps Enkidu. How does he trap Enkidu? Here's the king, they go to him, and he gets a prostitute to sleep with Enkidu. Because then the beasts will reject him. So Enkidu sleeps with this prostitute for 6 days and 7 nights until, quote, until he is satisfied. right? But then he could not run so fast. Yet he was wiser, right? Is that like a little bit, does that remind you of Eden? What do they learn when they learn knowledge, right? They have shame because they're naked, right? Something about sexuality, right? Although, by the way, that story does not promote knowledge, right? That's okay, it's bad there in that story, right? But anyway, this way this one goes, it's just some connection of him sexuality making him civilized, in other words. And then he lives with the shepherds, and he goes to wrestle Gilgamesh. And they wrestle, and neither one can win. They see they're well matched, and they become great friends. So you have, now you have Gilgamesh and Enkidu as the bosom buddies. And this is one thing heroes do, they have a bosom buddy, you know. And they decide to go on adventures together. So now you have a team, Gilgamesh and Enkidu, okay? And what's their first adventure? Actually, there's good versions of this. There's a good version for children that I bought a couple to give away a couple of times with nice illustrations. It's around. It's a great read. They decide that they want their names to live on. And that would be a type of immortality. Gilgamesh doesn't know if he's going to live forever. But he wants his name to live on. That's called indirect immortality, fame. So, immortality of your name. So they decide to go to the edges of kind of the civilized world where there's a forest called the Land of Cedars, guarded by a monster, Humbaba. Or originally he was Huwawa in the other language, Sumerian. And they decide to kill him. And now it doesn't say why, just they want to become famous. Why do people climb mountains, right? Because it's there, right? Although I think there's a little more to this, because we said the story had 2,000-year history. And in older versions, the cedar forest, where they just had to kill this guardian. In other versions, that's called the land of the living. The land of the living means who lives there? Gods. Gods are the living, people are not, right? So in older versions, it suggests that maybe they're going to go over the limits to reach some land of the gods where people aren't supposed to go. Although that's not, it's not stressed here, because the name changed from land of the living to cedar forest. And in this story, it turns out Gilgamesh learns a lesson and he has to die. That's the bad news, the ending. Okay, so that's kind of maybe left out of it, but that might have been in the earlier name. It might have implied that. That's why they're going there, to go someplace special. So they go kill this guardian, Humbaba, and at first, it's actually very realistic. They're terrified before him. Heroes are not always like cartoon heroes, right? But we tell the stories that way. Have you seen the Disney Hercules movie? Right? Or if you see like an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or a cartoon, this is going to be some comic book strongman, right? Superman, right? Didn't the president of Venezuela just say at the UN, don't watch these things, they make you stupid, read this book, right? So, because these are too simple. Heroes in ancient stories, they're more like people. They get terrified and they can't do anything they want to. They're like people. So they're afraid, and the sun god actually helps them, who is called Shamash, or Utu would be the older name for him. And they help Gilgamesh supplying 8 winds that paralyze Humbaba, and this monster begs for his life, but Gilgamesh slays him, which is maybe not that nice. And so that's their first adventure. They slay Humbaba. And it says just for their name. In other words, the story doesn't go on that they go to the forest or anything there. But I was just saying that maybe that was significant in earlier versions that were edited out. Okay, so then the gods are furious at them. The sky god Enlil is furious that they killed this guardian. So, but Inanna is very impressed with Gilgamesh. Who's Inanna? Do you know what she's the goddess of? Inanna is the goddess of love and war, since we know these go together. And she's also called Ishtar, or Astarte, or Aphrodite. Right? So, how love and war go together, that's a different story we can say later. Okay? So, Inanna is in love with Gilgamesh. He's the big stud, so to speak. And she wants him to be her lover. But he refuses. And he says, look what happened to all your lovers. You turned them all into animals. And it goes through mythology. What about this one? You turned him into a bird. What about this one? You sent him to the underworld, your place. And he actually recounts all these bad fates. Which lover did you love forever? And he says, you're bad news. You're like charcoal that goes out in the fireplace. You're like a bad shoe that pinches the wearer's foot. It's very kind of very quaint insults in this poetry. And a few, some lines about that. Well, this is bad. You're not supposed to insult a goddess. So Inanna now is mad, and she gets the sky god, her father, Anu. They have a couple of sky gods. To send the bull of heaven to ravage Uruk. So this is actually Gilgamesh's second adventure, to fight the bull of heaven. And it's the killing the young men of Uruk by the hundreds. And Gilgamesh and Enkidu slay the bull of heaven. But this is sent by the gods. So now the gods are angry. Okay. And the gods say, and actually they do more. They insult the gods. Enkidu throws the thigh of the bull of heaven at Inanna, the goddess of love. And thigh is probably a euphemism for the genital area. And you're not supposed to do that. So that's rubbing it in. And the gods say, one of you must die. So Enkidu has to die. And he dies in the description of death, which is actually the theme of this work, which is why it's great literature, because it's about existence, it's about us, not just what somebody did so many thousands of years ago, right? It's not history, but existential myth. Okay, so Enkidu has to die. He goes to the house which is never left. The description of death as the house of ashes, where you can never return from. Do you remember the Roach Motel? If you lived in New York, they would say, remember the motto? They can check in, but they can't check out, right? So this was their view of death, right? So Enkidu dies, and Gilgamesh can't believe it. What's happening? He sees his body rotting, maggots actually in his nose, and he says, will this happen to me? Am I going to die? And this is where he gets the dilemma, is he a god or a mortal? So Gilgamesh goes on the search for life. And this is his quest. This is his journey. That goes puts it into the spiritual level for the hero to go to the limits to find what's beyond the gods. So by the way, maybe we can't say, have enough time to say what that is right now, but he goes to look, to seek the survivor of the flood, who's in Dilmun, the island of the gods, who got saved and transported there. He's going to find out the secret from him about how he lives on. And here's where we get a flood story. Okay, so let's say one thing about what we said so far. Okay, that becomes a spiritual quest. That's a new type of adventure. The first two adventures were defeating monsters. That's another typical thing heroes do. The hero is like the good guy, you know, against the bad guy. So that you could see as the hero represents order against disorder. You could say that's like cosmos defeating chaos, like the gods had to do to establish order. The gods did that to establish the cosmos. Heroes do that on Earth. You kill a beast that's ravaging your field. Some force of disorder in order to keep the world safe, right? They do it on Earth. So the gods act, they're like gods, again, acting on Earth to bring order to the Earth. So this is called the dragon combat. This kind of thing is typical of heroes fighting bulls. Hercules does lots of these. It's typical for Greek heroes too. Okay? And we're going to run out of time in a minute. I'll just say quickly, and we'll say more next time. Gilgamesh goes to this character. He has a long journey across the earth. Say, this is the earth, and surrounded by waters on all sides. That's the waters, okay? On all sides. He goes to the east, where the sun rises. He goes through a mountain, through a tunnel. Comes out the other side, and he has to be ferried over by the ferryman to Dilmun. There's different details of the journey, and the ferryman is like the ferryman of the dead in Greek. He uses 300 poles, because every time he touches the water, it's so deadly, he can't touch the pole again, he has to use 300 poles. In Greek, when you die, you go across the river Styx, you're ferried across. So this is like saying you're going from our world to the world beyond, the other world. And at first, this was conceived horizontally. They didn't have heaven and earth above and below, that's where the gods were. This is horizontally beyond the earth, beyond the waters, some island beyond the waters. Okay, so that's where he has to go. There's a good description of that. And he meets Udna Pushtim. I'll say it quick in a couple of minutes. Is that okay? Okay. Yeah, sure. I mean, I can stay 10 minutes or something. Is that right? So he says, Unapishtim, you're the... I want to say all the details here. There's interesting things along the way, just characters he meets, and becomes wilder and wilder as he goes beyond the civilized world. And he comes to Unapishtim at this place, Dilmun, who's a survivor of the flood, has been transported here. And he says, Unapishtim, you live forever. What is the secret? I want this. I don't want to die like Enkidu. I'm on the secret of life. And Unapishtim says, well, let me tell you about the flood. At this point, he tells him the flood story. One god saved me. I landed on this mountain, Mount Nimush, or Mount Nisir. There are different languages and different mountains. I released a dove. Does it know I do this, right? And this happened to me. But that was a long time ago. It only happened once. Some god picked me up. It's not going to happen again. You just can't get that, you know? So it's over. So Gilgamesh says, well, I really want to. Let me try hard. And Unapishtim says, okay, if you can stay awake, let's see if you can conquer sleep. If you want to conquer death, conquer sleep first. And Gilgamesh says, okay. And 7 days later, Gilgamesh says, look, I stayed awake. And Unapishtim says, no, you slept the whole time. I'll prove it to you. Every day you were sleeping for 7 days, my wife baked a loaf of bread. Look here, they're all decaying. They're in different states of decay. That's an image of the passage of time. What is that? Nature. Nature gives decay. Decay is built into nature, right? The bread is the natural process bringing life and death. So Gilgamesh says, oh, now I'm really bummed. And now what do I do? I can't even stay awake. And Unapishtim says, okay, thanks for playing. I'll give you a door prize just for playing. Show them what we have for him. And he says, okay, here, take this one herb. It will restore your youth. And so Gilgamesh heads home and takes this plant. He makes a little mistake that he doesn't ingest the plant. And he's carrying it, and he stops at a well to bathe. Up from the well comes a serpent and eats this plant of restoring youth, and this helps the serpent. What does the serpent get from that? The snake. What do snakes do to restore their youth? Shed. That's why snakes shed their skin. It's an etiology. So they get that. Snakes are often good in myth. They're usually with healing, the earth, regeneration like that. Of course, you might think of the snake in Eden as well, but we won't say that now. And so Gilgamesh heads home, and now he has nothing. Now he has lost it. He goes home. He realizes he's a man. He's going to die. That's the message. It's a message for everyone. It's how these hero stories are about existence, not just some great cartoon character who's different, but about us. He learns about life. And he says, I will build my city. I will build the walls now. I will build up Uruk and do what I can. So it becomes actually a secular message. And the Sumerians had this saying, remember your humanity. This became a motto in the 50s, actually, of somebody, in the anti-nuclear movement, this was used by Einstein and Russell. But this was found in Sumerian. So now you move from gods to people again, but it was very somewhat pessimistic for people. People are part of nature, whatever is born dies. Even the gods are part of that and not all good. So there's so many things about the universe here. So it's not all about psychology, it's not all about society, it's not all about gender, it's about the universe and everybody, I would say. Okay, thanks for getting that story in for a couple of minutes. Who had a pressing question, please?
About myths is when we look at other people's myths, like the Texans going to look for the Ark,
yeah.
We find that funny, I do myself, but hard enough, don't all of us have myths that are pretty ridiculous? Are you really?
Of course, maybe you need them. Maybe it's part, what's an example?
Well, I just remember when I was in grammar school, I never forget this, John Kennedy was inaugurated.
Yeah.
And the nuns had us all come together, and they had a global problem that he was a sin. But then he found out
first Catholic.
Standards, he was a man of, you know, staggering immorality. So, I mean, it was a misdeveloped there, I thought.
Yeah, of course. And he still is. The Camelot and the way Clinton actually copied that quite a bit. Maybe we need myths. Maybe we want myths more than facts. I always use OJ for that. They didn't want the facts, you know. They wanted a certain view of things.
This is not the end of the Gilgamesh story, is it?
Yes.
It is. Why is it considered similar to resurrection?
No, it's not resurrection. It's a story about mortality and death.
The opposite.
There's one little thing added on, which is usually excluded here. There's some other little story added on about how he's a dream of Enkidu in the underworld or something like that. I don't even remember now. But that's found in the 12th tablet, but thought to be separate. No, it's a very... negative view, which was an ancient view. People are not gods. People are not saved. We're living in this world. We're born. We die. We have floods. We have things coming down on our heads. Good and evil mixed together, and you can't figure out. It's inscrutable. Question. Okay.
It seems the most successful of these are stories that are both interesting and useful.
Sure.
Santa Claus is interesting and teaches. If you're good, you get rewarded. If you're bad, you're...
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, Santa Claus has a moral message. Gilgamesh is useful, too. Although it may not be what everybody wants. Everybody wants the message that you're going to die. We have other stories that you will go to heaven. So these are stories, you know. We don't know. But so it's probably whichever story you find most useful, too. You know, both of those could be psychologically good, depending on which one you want.
You need to be well told.
Yeah. Yes, so read Gilgamesh. It's really the best. We'll go to the Greek stuff next time. Okay? Thanks. Thank you.